This is Ken McDermott Rowe. We're very pleased to have as our special guest David Courtwright to discuss his book, Soldiers in Revolt. Soldiers in Revolt is an account of GI resistance during the Vietnam War. It was originally published in 1975 and was recently republished by Haymarket Books. Mr. Courtwright is both a prolific author and a longtime peace activist. His many books include Peace Works, The Citizen's Role in Ending the Cold War, A Peaceful Superpower, The Movement Against War in Iraq, and most recently, Gandhi and Beyond, Nonviolence in an Age of Terrorism. Mr. Courtwright is a research fellow at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at University of Notre Dame. Additionally, he's the president of Fourth Freedom Forum, a peace advocacy foundation, and has advised UN agencies and national governments on how to resolve conflict without war, especially through the use of economic tools. Mr. Courtwright, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Mr. Courtwright, before we get into your book, I think it would be helpful to our many listeners who are not that familiar with the history of the Vietnam War, if you could give us a brief overview, when it was and what it was about and how many people were involved.
Vietnam War began really in the early 1960s, perhaps even as late as the late 1950s. It involved the United States imposing a government in South Vietnam and then attempting to prevent the unification of North and South Vietnam and fighting against the opposition, the resistance inside South Vietnam and against the North Vietnamese Army. Full-scale U.S. combat involvement began in 65. That's when the Marines and major Army divisions invaded. And we remained in Vietnam until 1972, the last peace agreement was finally settled in 1973. During that time, the United States waged a massive all-out war against Indochina. We had more than 500,000 ground troops in Indochina from the period of the mid-60s through into the early 70s. More than half of all the air power, all the bombers and airplanes in the U.S. military were deployed against Indochina for 6, 7, 8 years. 59,000 American soldiers died. The number of Vietnamese, Indochinese killed is not known with certainty, but Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during those years, he estimated that the number of Indochinese who died as a result of U.S. military intervention in the war in Indochina, more than 3 million people died. The United States dropped more bombs and shells on Indochina during those years than were dropped in all the theaters of World War II combined. In fact, three times as much, 7.5 million tons of bombs and shells were dropped on Indochina during those years. So it was a huge, savage war. Many of the American frontline combat divisions suffered very high rates of casualties, equivalent to what they suffered during the worst battles of World War II. There's a myth going around in American culture and the political establishment that we somehow fought the war in Vietnam with our hands tied, you know, that we were stabbed in the back by the politicians, et cetera. That's not true. It was anyone who was there will tell you it was a massive bloody battle went on for years and years, and the United States simply could not prevail, and the political opposition in the United States internally grew to the point where the war was no longer sustainable politically.
From the perspective of the U.S. government, it was a war against communist expansion, but from the perspective of the Vietnamese, it was an anti-colonial war for national liberation.
Exactly. The Vietnamese had been struggling for their independence really for thousands of years, but certainly for more than 100 years from the time when the French colonized Indochina. They fought against the French, especially toward after World War II. And they defeated the French, and they had this battle in 1954 where they defeated the French, and there was an agreement whereby the Vietnamese would be allowed to control their own country, and there would be an election, they would elect their own president, etc. The U.S. sabotaged that agreement in the mid-1950s. We set up a separate government in the South that was illegitimate, that was actually illegal according to the Geneva Agreement, and we essentially tried to reimpose Western domination in Vietnam, and try to resist a what I considered and most people around the world considered a legitimate national liberation movement that was simply striving to establish an independent Vietnamese state.
Now, during the early years of the Vietnam War, you were in college?
I was in college, went to Notre Dame, graduated in 1968. So during the early years of the war, I was pretty much oblivious and not paying attention to.
So you weren't a political person?
Not at all. I was, conservative. I came out of a Catholic family. I really didn't pay attention to politics, and as I say, was pretty conservative and didn't think much about all the larger issues facing the world.
Hey, you came to become in the Army after you graduated?
Yeah, well, a couple days after I graduated from college, I went home and I immediately received a notice to report for my military draft physical. So I didn't know what hit me. It was like within literally days. And then a couple months later, I was in the Army. So there's nothing like being drafted to fight in a war to focus your attention and to make you think about international affairs. And I must confess that I really didn't even know where Vietnam was. I had to look on a map. But I wanted to know, obviously, and I wanted to find out what was going on and see if all what the politicians were saying was correct. So I started to read history books about Vietnam. I tried to learn as much as I could about it. And the more I learned, the more I began to question what the political leaders were saying. And the more I realized that this was really an unjust war.
You had a very your experience at basic training was something that had a great effect on you. You write.
Yeah, well, I was in basic training again. Shocked at being in the military, coming right out of college, and the kind of mindless brutality that is part of basic training, the way in which in the military they try to basically break you down, so that you're simply an automaton responding to any orders. Was completely contrary to anything I had ever experienced. And in particularly the kind of the cruelty of it. The fellows who were not as physically able, who couldn't keep up with the basic training, whatever, they ridiculed them, they made fun of them. And it's just the insanity of it all really bothered me and began to deepen these questions that I had about what was going on. I remember they had a propaganda film one time where they were trying to tell us why we were all going to be going to Vietnam, and the more we watched it, the more there were hoots and howls in the audience, and so the sergeant got up and said, "You men, be quiet. You may gonna have to learn something. You better listen." And then we'd be in training, and they'd say, "You better listen, or they're gonna shoot your ass off." And they almost seemed to relish it. The sergeants, we were cannon fodder going into this war, but it was the whole experience was extremely disturbing, and it just raised more and more questions about what was going on, and then especially the prospect that I might be going over there myself.
At your first assignment at Fort Hamilton, you had the opportunity to meet many veterans who were coming back from Vietnam. How did that affect you?
Yeah, again, this was part of the further questioning. They told us to stay away from the coffee shop during break time, and so, of course, we tried to go over anyway, and I could see the reason why, because all the Vietnam vets were returning back. Fort Hamilton was a base where troops who were coming back from Nam would be rotated out and be discharged.
This is in New York City, right?
New York, right outside on the edge of the city out in Brooklyn. And so guys who lived in New York area would be processing back. And when you talk to them, there was a shocking experience. They were embittered. They had long hair. They were sort of a violation of Army regulations in every respect. And they would make fun of you as a new guy. Where do you get over there? And just to see how embittered and angry and alienated these guys were was, again, a further shock. And it wasn't that they were political. They weren't saying, "Oh, America is fighting an unjust war." But you could tell that the war was going badly, that they did not feel good about their experience, and that they were angry about what they had to experience, what they had to go through.
You wrote that I came to see the war as not just a mistake, but a crime.
Yeah, and this was, while this was going on, I was getting more and more upset, nervous. I was really going through a kind of a personal crisis and trauma. I couldn't sleep well. I was just really going through trauma personally. A friend of mine later said I had a crisis of conscience. I didn't know what it was at the time, but it was grueling, and it was this realization, these questions, and especially as I read the history, and I learned about what the Vietnamese were trying to do and who they were. And I remember having this realization that Ho Chi Minh was like the George Washington of Vietnam, and that this struggle that they were fighting was a just one. And the army in which I was serving and the war in which I might have to serve was on the wrong side, basically what I felt. And a lot of guys shared that opinion. And, you know, it's a horrible thing when you realize, you know, I'm 22 years old, I'm in the army, and I may have to go in and fight a war. I'm already part of the war and being part of the army, but I'm supporting a mission that I see as unjust and really fighting, if you will, for the wrong side.
You got involved in the anti-war movement in New York City. How did that happen?
Well, I was going to the city at night, trying to hang out with people. I was trying to find a way to go to graduate school. And as I was exploring around at NYU and Columbia and schools in the city, I saw a poster for, there were lots of anti-war posters, but there was one in particular that called for a meeting of GIs and veterans. And I remember, wow, that's very interesting. And I was very nervous, thinking that maybe this is a setup. Maybe it's either the Army trying to get us or maybe some lefty commie group is trying to exploit us. You know, I was very nervous. But I went into this meeting anyway, and I found other service members, other soldiers from other bases around the New York area and New Jersey, Fort Dix. And they were genuine. They were right there where I was in terms of their feelings. And it just really seemed like a very solid group. It was a wonderful experience, and it was something that I felt I wanted to dedicate myself to. It was a kind of a relief from this crisis, this personal crisis that I was experiencing, and it gave me a sense of purpose in a way that I could be in the Army but still express my deep sense of opposition to this war and my commitment to try to bring it to an end.
How did the other soldiers react to your involvement in the anti-war movement?
Well, back at Fort Hamilton, most of the guys that I talked to were very interested and very supportive. And, you know, I'd say, hey, I went to this meeting and there's going to be a peace rally in New York and they want to have a special contingent of service members, of GIs, marching in the front. What do you think? And most guys would say, well, hey, that's great, that's cool, you know. Not that many, frankly, would agree to do it because they knew there were risks involved. And maybe they didn't want to jeopardize their families, the prospects of getting a job. Maybe they were hoping to get promotions or whatever. But there were very few who said, oh, no, that's wrong, don't do that. That's, you know, against our mission or, you know, it's commie or whatever. There were most of the members of the people back on the base were supportive. Although, as I say, only a minority were willing to take the risk to actually go out there and show up in the streets and be demonstrating and to sign petitions and that sort of thing.
You did involve yourself with a petition that was published in the New York Times?
Yeah. This is one of our most famous actions, something I'm very proud of. In 1969, so this, I'm based at Fort Hamilton and becoming more and more active in opposing the war. Sometime in the summer, I guess it was, of 69, there were other soldiers opposing the war, not just at Fort Hamilton, but at almost every major U.S. military base by this time. There's a group of soldiers who are opposing the war. And I was starting to be in communication with some of these other groups. And I got word of a petition that was circulating. And the idea was to have as many active duty soldiers as possible sign a petition and have it placed in the New York Times. And so we circulated. We had, I think, 50 or 60 of the soldiers at Fort Hamilton signed it, and we sent it into this group. And then it was published in the New York Times, full-page ad, the Sunday before the big Vietnam moratorium rally in Washington. I believe it was November 15, 69, one of the largest demonstrations against the war in that whole period. Something like 400,000 people gathered at the Washington Monument. And again, it was led by a group of active duty soldiers and recent vets. And many people made reference to the soldiers who had signed that petition. We had 1,366 active duty GIs sign that petition that appeared in the Times. We were from dozens of military bases in the U.S., from Korea, Germany, from dozens of ships in the Navy, and even quite a number from Vietnam. It was truly a statement representing all the different branches of the military and most of the major military bases.
Did your involvement in this relate to your transfer to Fort Bliss, Texas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I made the decision to start to speak out, I knew that the command would not take lightly to this and that there were risks involved and we were likely to face some kind of punishment, court-martial, punitive transfers, punitive assignments. But when I did it, I felt that I had to take that chance because I just couldn't continue with business as usual and just be following along and supporting this war. So while we're speaking out and doing these things, we're always waiting for the shoe to drop. And sure enough, there was an incident where the command used it as an excuse. And so I think it was in the spring of 1970, maybe it was even in the summer of 1970, the command came down with a whole series of punishments. Part of their response was to transfer 8 of us at Fort Hamilton who were defined as the troublemakers and the ringleaders of this supposed subversive movement. So, we were transferred out on 1 week notice. You know, usually you get a month or more to transfer to a new location. And there were other kind of punitive measures that were imposed. So what we did, instead of just lying down and taking this, we decided to fight back. And we went to a lawyer and we entered into civilian court, federal district court in New York. And we filed a motion in the court saying that these transfers and these other punishments that the command had imposed were illegal attempts to suppress our First Amendment rights, that they were not at all required by military duty, but were instead an attempt to suppress our First Amendment rights. So we went into federal court, and we were pleasantly surprised that the federal court accepted the jurisdiction in the case. He did not grant a restraining order, which we had requested, but the judge did take jurisdiction and said that there would be a hearing. So I went to Fort Bliss, which is where I was sent. That's down in Texas. But the judge said that the Army had to bring me back to the federal court in New York whenever a hearing would be required so that he could hear the case and decide whether these transfers were, in fact, illegal.
When you got to Fort Bliss, you found the state of discipline there to be pretty bad. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this is 1970, and by this time, throughout much of the U.S. military, morale and discipline are reaching rock-bottom levels. There's so much opposition to the war. The resistance to the war is racking our society in general, and it's also affecting the military. And at Fort Bliss, for example, they would have morning reveille. In those days, we still had it, and supposedly at 6 o'clock, you would muster down on the parade ground and say, "All present and accounted for, sir." And I remember the first day I got up, you know, dutifully thinking, "Better get down there." And I looked around, and half the guys were still laying in their bunks, and nobody was really stirring. And it was when you went down to the parade ground, it was a joke. The battalion leader would say, "All present and accounted for, sir," and you could look down the line, and there were only like 3 guys there or something. So there was, you know, kind of a disregard for orders and discipline. There was lots of drugs around the base. The potheads were in one area smoking pot all the time. There were others doing heavier drugs, heroin. There was a lot of racial tension. The African-American troops mostly stayed to themselves and went around with big Afro haircuts and these walking sticks, they called them, with these carved fists at the top, and were, you know, basically almost daring the commanders to try to discipline them. So the things were very loose. The stockade was jammed full. There was another special processing detachment where that was also jammed full. These were those who had violated the law. And then there was another unit called Special Troops. That's where they put me. And we were the ones who were troublemakers, but we hadn't actually broken the law. And so it was very chaotic, and discipline was very poor. Morale was rock bottom.
At Fort Bliss and other bases, there was an organized peace activity, and a lot of it had to do with newspapers and coffee houses. Can you talk about that, the role they played?
Yeah. When I got to Fort Bliss, they already had a GI peace group there when I arrived in the summer of 1970, and they had an underground GI newspaper. Called them underground papers in those days. Basically, it was a newspaper that we wrote ourselves as soldiers. We mimeographed it off-duty in the evenings, and then we would pass it around on the base and ask for contributions from soldiers to support the work of our GIs for Peace group there at Fort Bliss. And there were similar anti-war, so-called underground newspapers all over the military. When I did research later for my book, Soldiers in Revolt, I was able to discover more than 250 of these newspapers. Some, you know, published only one or two issues. Others lasted for years. There was one at Fort Hood, Texas, called the Oleo Strut. It's named after a part of a helicopter. The Oleo Strut was in publication from around 1968 right through 73. So Bragg Briefs, also at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, stayed in publication for many years. So there were hundreds, literally, of these newspapers circulating all around the bases. At Fort Bliss, we would print about 3,000 copies. Fort Bliss had about 15,000 troops at that time. So we would take our 3,000 copies, and we would go downtown in El Paso, which is right near Juarez, Mexico. And on payday, when all the troops were getting off and going into Juarez to party, we would stand by the bridges and hand out copies and ask for contributions. We always got a very positive response from the troops. We would collect hundreds of dollars in contributions, and that would be our budget for the month. So these kinds of things were going on. And there were also these coffee houses. We had one at downtown El Paso as well, and there was a coffee shop at Fort Hood and Fort Bragg. There were at least 15 coffee houses outside major military bases in the U.S., also in the Philippines. And these were places where soldiers would come after duty and on weekends. And I used to go there all the time to our coffee shop in El Paso. And it was basically a place to hang out, to meet, to talk with others, to kind of get away from the Army for a few hours or for a weekend. We would have our organizing and political meetings there as well. So if we had a speaker coming through town, we would host them at our coffee shop. We had, for our GIs for Peace group, we had weekly meetings. And so each week, 20, 30 GIs would show up, and we'd talk about our plans for the newspaper and how we were trying to build opposition to the war. So it was really a great place to go and really escape from the Army.
Now, for the GIs that were fighting in Vietnam, they didn't have the opportunity to express themselves in that way. How did they evidence their dissent for the war?
Well, in Vietnam, the opposition to the war was also very high, but of course you can't publish an underground newspaper and there's no coffee house opportunities. But you had also then the much more extreme conditions and direct combat experience, and so the reaction was much sharper and in some cases even more violent. In Vietnam, the military discipline and effectiveness of the ground troops steadily deteriorated, especially after 1968-69. And I think it's fair to say by 1970, the Army in Vietnam was barely functioning and was certainly not an effective force for sustaining U.S. combat operations.
The word mutiny comes up.
Yes.
There were evidences of that.
Many combat refusals, as they called them. That's the Army phrase for it, but mutiny is another phrase. When I did research for Soldiers in Revolt, I found evidence of at least 10 public incidents of mutiny, one of which was even filmed on CBS television. But later on, as I did more research, I found that there were many more incidents of combat refusal. In the 1st Cav Division, for example, there were, we later discovered, more than 30 incidents of combat refusal in that one division.
This would be where the enlisted soldiers tell the senior non-com or their officer that they don't intend to go someplace?
Yeah. they send you down and they say, okay, we're going down this path. And the troops would say, no, we're not. We want to go this way, or we just want to stay here.
That brings to mind the phrase I saw in your book, Battlefield Democracy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was actually in Life magazine, I believe it was, in 69 or 70, there was an article, front page article, and the headline was, "You just can't hand out orders anymore." And what it meant was many officers basically had to negotiate with the troops when you're out in the field. And when officers did not do that, then you had a tragic and violent response at times. There was a word that entered the lexicon during the Vietnam War, a tragic, horrible phrase, fragging. And what it means is attacking your officers or sergeants with a fragmentation grenade. And the Army kept statistics on these incidents, and I looked it up and found that there were more than 500 recorded incidents of fragging. And I think it's, I don't have the figures in front of me, but something like 85, 86 officers and sergeants were killed by their own men.
Would this be done in combat or after combat by putting it in the person's tent?
Yeah, there was a whole protocol, actually. And, you know, you talk to the guys who've been there, they'll admit it. An officer, a non-com who is trying to be gung-ho, who's trying to get a medal by pushing the troops into risky combat, or who might be riding the African-American guys, or who might be trying to crack down on all the potheads who are smoking marijuana, whatever it might be. Those kinds of officers and sergeants were the ones who usually got victimized. And the protocol was the troops would first put a frag in the officer's on his bunk or maybe in his office. And that's the warning. And then if the behavior didn't change, then sometimes there'd be a smoke grenade. And then if the harassment or the, you know, gung-ho behavior continued, then tragically sometimes there were killings that took place. So it was just a horrible expression of how widespread was the dissatisfaction, the disarray, the deterioration of the armed forces in that period.
There's a quote you use in your book from Shelby Stanton, who wrote The Rise and Fall of an American Army. Quote, "The American forces were withdrawn from Vietnam because they ceased to be an effective fighting force."
Right. That's right.
You quote a man named Fred Brampman, an article he wrote in Liberation magazine, April 1971. The article was entitled "The New Totalitarianism," and it was eerily prescient in his description of the new approach to the war. He was talking about Nixon's new way of pursuing the Vietnam War, and he described the new policy as, quote, "automated warfare fought without conscripts by a smaller force composed as much as possible of technicians. This would eliminate opposition amongst an indifferent public and a powerless Congress." And that seems to be where we got.
Yes. Well, Fred Brampton was the foremost expert on the air war in those days, and especially the less known aspects of the air war over Laos and Cambodia. But this was the trend. This was how the administration responded to the resistance in the military. And there's a pattern. The first and strongest opposition emerged among the Marines because they were the first to be most heavily engaged in combat in Vietnam. Then the Army, this is 68, 69, and 70. As the ground forces became increasingly rebellious and less and less effective for military missions, the Nixon administration increased the use of air power. So at various times, there were 3 and 4 aircraft carriers on station in the Gulf of Tonkin, continuously bombing Indochina. And there were 3 or 4 major air bases in Thailand. B-52s were sent from Guam. It was a massive air war. And this involved tens of thousands of airmen and sailors aboard the carriers and at the bases. And initially, the strategy worked because these troops were relatively removed from the war. You're flying at 30,000 feet or you're out in the carrier, you know, 500 miles away. It's different than being in the rice paddy. But eventually, the anti-war movement emerged in the Navy and Air Force as well. And by 71, and certainly by 72, you saw a huge increase in the level of anti-war resistance among Navy and Air Force personnel. There were these underground newspapers that I mentioned began to pop up at major Navy bases and aboard ships. and also at major air bases. In the Navy, 1972 probably ranks as one of the most rebellious years in the history of the U.S. Navy. There were two major sabotage incidents in which aircraft carriers were put out of commission by sabotage perpetrated by low-ranking sailors. One was the USS Ranger in California, and then the Forrestal, which was based at Norfolk at the time. Both were put out of action in the summer of 72 by sabotage. And there were also major rebellions, so-called mutinies, aboard aircraft carriers. One was on the Constellation, which was based in San Diego, when I think the number is 70, 80, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but a good number of sailors refused to post to the ship as it was getting ready to sail to Indochina. And so they had to delay the sailing and go down to the dock and try to persuade these guys to get on board. And then there was a rebellion, mostly a racial rebellion that occurred aboard the USS Kitty Hawk. I believe it was October of 72. And this is while the Kitty Hawk was on station, bombing Indochina on a regular basis. The ship was supposed to be rotating back to the Philippines for rest and then return to the U.S., and they had to rotate back to Indochina. And as they were returning and engaging in bombing operations, the tensions on the ship really exploded, and especially the African-American troops rebelled. And there was a full-scale rebellion and riot going on in the ship for several hours that night. There was really no one in control. They thought that the CO had been killed. The XO came on the intercom and took command. The Marine Guard was roaming through the ship. There were beatings. It was horrendous. I think dozens were injured. I can't remember if anyone was killed, but it was a serious uprising. It was so serious that the House Armed Services Committee had a full-scale hearing just on the Kitty Hawk incident a few weeks later. So this was, again, an expression of how much the discipline and morale in the military deteriorated and how it spread even to the Navy and the Air Force.
Well, although the United States government was defeated in Vietnam, the new policies were carried forward, that of automated warfare with these so-called smart bombs,
right,
and the technicians we see in the volunteer army concept. That brings us to the Iraq War. How does the opposition of soldiers today, do you think, compare with the oppositions of the American soldiers during the Vietnam War?
Well, it's a good point you make about the overall strategy to focus on automated warfare, and especially more and more with these precision-guided weapons and these robotic tools and weapons that they have now. So they can conduct war to a significant extent without involving the troops directly. But the Iraq War is an occupation, and as the U.S. became bogged down in this occupation by late 03, 04, the troops became directly involved in the dirtiest and most horrible kinds of warfare. And you've seen the stories and heard the accounts of the vets who are coming back. Our troops are now engaged in gritty urban warfare, battling insurgents in the streets of these cities. They're shooting at cars as they drive up the checkpoints. So it's the worst kind of direct, immediate combat. And as this experience has worsened and continued, we're seeing a replay of what we encountered in Vietnam. That is to say, the troops are more and more beginning to question the mission. We're not seeing the kind of overt rebellion and mutinies and the things that we saw during Vietnam. But
is that because there is no draft, do you think?
Yes, and of course the biggest factor is that today all the people in the military are volunteers and professionals, and most of them are actually making the military, if not a career, at least a long-term commitment, 8 years, 12 years, and many go for the full 20 years. And people are joining the military because they need the job.
And
they need the educational benefits and the training.
As you mentioned in the new edition of your book, the mobilization of the Reserve and Guard added a different element to Iraq that wasn't present in Vietnam. Many of these people are married, have families, and so they're coming to the war today, not with the same attitude as someone who enlisted to go to war.
Exactly. And, nowadays when you're in there, the majority are married, actually, now. And so you have to think not only of yourself, but your family, your children, and of your career. The consequences of getting a less than honorable discharge when you've been a volunteer in the military are quite severe. So there's enormous pressures to stay with the mission and to, you know, support the institution of the armed forces.
How would you compare the response of the government to Vietnam War GIs who opposed the war to its response to GIs today who oppose the war in Iraq?
Well, it's quite different because the service members today who are speaking out are doing so in a more respectful way, if you will, and without the kinds of direct resistance and rebellion that we experienced during the Vietnam days. So, for example, you have this appeal for redress, which is probably the most widespread or largest expression of anti-war sentiment. There's like 1,800 active duty service members who signed this appeal. But if you read the appeal, it's very respectful. It simply says, you know, it says, I'm proud to wear the uniform as a member of the armed forces, but I urge my member of Congress to seek a prompt end to this war. It's not worth it, and it can't be not worth the price. So it's a simple but respectful and patriotic statement. And it also turns out to be completely legal. The service members who came up with this idea, I was advising them, they looked very carefully at the military regulations and found that they have a perfectly legal right to communicate with their member of Congress. So that's the way they framed this appeal, and it's proving to be very popular in the ranks. And so the military, they don't like it, the commanders don't like it, but they can't repress it. And the other thing we're finding is that quite a number of the commanders and sergeants, you know, they may not sign it themselves, and they may not like the fact that their service members are signing, but many of them agree with the sentiment that's expressed.
It's interesting that in this war, you're seeing many high-ranking people dissent from the government's policies, such as General Wesley Clark, a four-star general, former commander of NATO.
Yeah.
You also had many generals and admirals, including JAG officers, who opposed the administration's torture policy.
That's right. And I think we've learned in this country about the nature of war policy and learn to support the troops in a more genuine way. And that slogan is thrown around as a kind of a way to support the war. That's what Bush means by it. But I think most Americans can now readily distinguish between supporting the troops, and that is respecting our members in the military and honoring the sacrifice and the hardships they're experiencing, but also recognizing that many of these very same troops do not agree with the mission, and that we can be fully supporting the troops and working to oppose this unjust and unworkable policy, this war in Iraq.
Is there a synergy developing between GIs who dissent from the war in Iraq and civilian peace advocates, as there did in Vietnam?
I think so. I think there's a real positive relationship that's been developing. You know, there was a myth perpetrated back in the Vietnam days that civilians spat on returning Vietnam vets. You know, that's Jerry Lemke wrote a book about this and found no evidence that this actually was the case. But let's grant that there was perhaps some hostility from anti-war people towards soldiers because there was a mistaken sense of blaming the troops for the war into which they had been sent. But nowadays, I think there's a much more sophisticated understanding that the troops have little choice in the matter and they are volunteers. But the troops are also coming forth now and telling us that this war is unworkable and that we need to get out. And some of them are openly expressing their position in opposing the war. And that has provided, I think, a tremendous encouragement and validation for the broader anti-war movement. Because we now know, as you say, that we're speaking not only on behalf of American citizens, but indeed even on behalf of the military, from the top-ranking generals right down to the privates and this, you know, the lower-ranking specialists.
In your new edition of Soldiers in Revolt, you wrote, quote, "The Vietnam experience taught us that resistance in the ranks is a potent force for restraining imperial ambitions and ending illegitimate war." What role do you think that ultimately the soldiers will play in ending our current imperialistic wars?
Well, I think they are starting to play a significant role and will play a decisive role as we bring this occupation to an end. obviously, the country has now turned against the war. Opinion polls show more and more support for getting out, setting a timeline, a year or so, and be gone. And one of the reasons why that tide of public opinion is turning is because of the voice of the military, the veterans, the service members, the senior generals who are speaking out. And more and more of the vets are speaking out. More and more of the military families are speaking out, and the service members. And as they do, that message will have a tremendous impact. You simply cannot impugn the integrity of someone who has been in Iraq, who's been in combat, and then who comes back and says, this war is wrong, we need to get out. And that message is getting across more and more to the public. And I'm hopeful that if we continue to mobilize and speak out over the next year or two, you can finally bring this horrendous military misadventure to an end.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Courtwright. We've been talking to David Courtwright, author of Soldiers in Revolt.
Thank you.
Could you hold on one second, David? Oh, thank you very much. That was really terrific. I appreciate, you know, you're having all your statistics there, because that added a lot of weight to the interview. So, I wish you good luck in your work, and thanks again for spending all the time with me.
Sure.
I hope that we have a chance to talk again.
All right. Anytime.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hey, I felt good about that. Yeah, that guy, unlike the propaganda professor, I felt like right away we're in the same wavelength.